Call this meeting of the House Elections Committee to order. There is a quorum present. The minutes are not quite yet available, so we will have a couple of them next week. So the first item, the first bill on the agenda is House File 3632, Representative Hewitt's bill. I will move that House File 3632 be recommended to be placed on the general register. There is an A1 amendment. Did you, Representative Hewitt, did you want that move to start with, or did you want to discuss the bill first?
Mr. Chair, if the committee could go ahead and move the amendment.
Okay. I will, is this just to put the bill in the shape you want?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I will move the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. There is an A2 amendment, but I understand that's not being offered, but if anybody, it's been posted. If anybody would like to, please raise your hand at any point. Let me know and I'll call on you. So Representative Hewitt, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. I really appreciate you hearing this. This was a bill brought to me by my county. I'm going to get to my notes here, which were great of staff to prepare for me. Under the current law, when a vacancy arises during a four-year term for the office of county attorney or county sheriff, the board must appoint an individual to fill the vacancy. That is the that's their only option. This legislation would simply adjust the law to allow the county board the option to either make appointments or call for a special election. The role of county attorneys and county sheriffs are often high profile positions in the community, and the public and the voters rightfully want to get to a direct stake in selecting the individuals that hold the offices. As far as the amendment goes, I just want to explain it briefly. The way the bill was written was that it actually was somewhat cumbersome, but there is a place in other parts of our statute that basically make it more simplified, and this follows what we're doing now in other areas that we do this. Today I have with me our distinct former colleague, but now Commissioner of Dakota County, Lori Halverson, and I would like her to testify.
Welcome back, Commissioner Halverson. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lori Halverson, Dakota County Commissioner. Good to see some of you all again. I'm here today in support of House File 3632. Dakota County, Representative Hewitt mentioned, had a situation when I was a new commissioner where we had the resignation of a county attorney who served for 30 years. And because it doesn't happen very often where you have a vacancy, there was a little bit of, frankly, surprise that we were required to appoint our county attorney. And we went through that process of appointment. And what became clear to me is that the appointment process ends up taking the voter out of a very important relationship. The county attorney and county sheriffs play an important role for our communities and our voters, and that relationship to me is one that shouldn't have a barrier between it put their finger on a scale and create an incumbent essentially to go into a general election. That said, I know that there are some questions about why county attorney and county sheriff and not other county officers, which I think is a really great question. The fact is the county attorney and the county sheriff not only serve the voters, but they serve a very specific role for county boards in that they are a separate and distinct elected office, but they are the attorney for the county. And so anytime the county is in litigation or county commissioners are in litigation, the county attorney's office is our attorney. And so having the voters make that choice and not us makes a lot of sense. And the same is true for sheriff. The sheriff provides distinct services to the board and to the voters. And so, and in addition, both of those offices have statutory requirements for service in that, for example, the county attorney, you have to be a licensed attorney. And so, issue of the board deciding who's eligible versus the going through the elections process where all of those checks are in place, to me, also provides more protection for the voters in that situation. So we always say, here's a simple bill, and I already explained how complex the thinking behind it is. But the bottom line is this bill provides a very thoughtful balance in allowing county boards to have the determination whether to appoint or elect. As I said, my preference would be to elect, but you can't even imagine how many scenarios we've walked through where they said, well, they might need to appoint in this situation. They might need to appoint in this situation. In addition, we all know that running a special election can be costly and be a surprise budget issue for county boards, and that may also weigh into a board's decision to appoint. That said, I'm very grateful to Representative Hewitt for bringing this bill forward and to you all for hearing it so that we can create a process that better represents the will of the voters when it comes to the representatives who are chosen to represent them for county attorney and county board. And I'm happy to answer additional questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Do any members of the public wish to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And about the amendment that was made, is that to align with, like 8 years ago, we specified if there was going to be a school referendum or a special election, it had to be within a certain set of dates so we could align stuff together and have it more organized. I just wanted to make sure that with the amendment, we are aligned with that practice.
I could go to House Research if you like, but I saw some nodding over there, Representative Hewitt.
And I got the nod from my testifier with great experience in this area. So, yes. And Representative Quam, yes, that's exactly, it came out of the Secretary of State's office, so yes.
Yeah. Representative
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That was a bill that one of the members sitting here was able to get through. So I just want to make sure we're consistent.
Nicely done. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this bill forward. I just thought I should mention the amendment that's been withdrawn. It turned out it had a more complicated effect than was realized by the author. Representative Harder brought the issue forward. I think she is going to explore the possibility of putting it into bill form, and down the road we may request a hearing on that bill along with others. And hopefully the chair will see fit to hear a Republican bill or two this year, because I know how understanding he is.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. I was excited for the opportunity to accept a GOP amendment there, but I heard a similar thing to what you did. So look forward to discussing that issue further. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one quick question. So, and maybe you explained it a little bit, but help me understand why wouldn't, so sheriff, county attorney, this makes sense. It does. But why wouldn't we include county commissioner in there?
Representative Hewitt.
Chair, I would like to turn that over to my testifier.
Commissioner Halverson.
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess as I explained, it's a different, when it comes to appointing county commissioners, I think that, I guess I didn't even think about it for county commissioners. Yeah. I'm going to have the Secretary of State's office explain this one better.
Okay. Welcome to
the. I researched the county auditor and the others.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and respond to the question.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and Representative Davis. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. I've spent a lot of time looking at county level offices and how the appointing and special elections things work over the last couple of days. So I can't say as to why the bill authors, you know, chose one way or another, but currently for county commissioners, there's a procedure where they can hold a special election, and if there is there's less than a year left, then they have an ability to appoint. They have an option to appoint, and it gets a little more complicated than that, but there is a, it's, I think it's 375-101 is where it outlines there, and I'm happy to email too, but there's many more qualifications and sort of switches depending on the timing and the situation and things like that. So that's, I guess, to give the background of what it is, and I think that was modified in like 2017 as well.
I think so. Okay. And Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Halverson.
So, and I appreciate Ms. Freeman explaining the replacement for county commissioners, and it really does put this these two other offices in line with the options available to counties. Currently, we are required. There are no options to hold a special election for county attorney or sheriff like there is for county commissioner.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a head nod will do. I actually had another question, but Ms. Freeman, if you could email me that, I'd really appreciate it. And thank you for the information. Thank you to the testifier as well. Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you. Any additional questions? All right, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Hewitt?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I like you, were willing and wanted to take the Harder Amendment. Unfortunately, we couldn't at this time, but I look forward to anything I can do to help with the situation. So I really would love to take that. So thank you for hearing it. We look forward to getting it on the floor.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3632, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Your bill is on its way. Representative Hewitt, thank you.
No roll call?
we're good, thank you. Next bill on the agenda is House File 3645. Representative Coulter, would you like to move, Representative Coulter, that House File 3645 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
I would love to move that.
Okay, Representative Coulter has moved the bill. Representative Coulter, to your bill.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I am here with House File 3645. And to sort of begin, I want to clarify that this bill refers only to political committees and funds. It does not apply to candidates. As I can explain later, it gets a little more dicey if we bring candidates in the equation. So, in broad strokes, what House File 3645 does is that it brings transparency and openness to political committees and funds that spend on candidates for local office and local ballot questions. And I know that many of us in this room have previously served in local office, city council, and school board. And all of us, I'm sure, have seen the changes that have happened as local issues become increasingly unlocalized and, for lack of a better term, politicized. And in many ways, local candidates and ballot questions have the most direct effect on our neighbors' lives. And I think it is important that Minnesotans know who is attempting to influence these elections. So again, to clarify, this only applies to committees and funds, not candidates. It does make some changes to Chapter 211A, that essentially make that chapter now strictly about local candidates. So just briefly to sort of walk through the bill, because there are, I think, a lot of sort of small pieces. Section 1 changes the definition of ballot question to include all local questions that could be on the ballot. Currently, as you can see, there are only certain instances where that's the case. Section 2 makes similar change to the definition of local candidate. Section 3 clarifies that in elections where there is not a primary election, that reports still need to be filed in July of the election year, regardless of whether or not there is a primary election. And I'm realizing now I skipped the part where I actually say what the bill does. So the bill requires committees and funds that spend on local elections to register and file with the state campaign finance board. Currently, certain committees and funds do so with local offices. This would centralize all of that within the state campaign finance board. Should have started there. Let's see, where was I? Section 3. Section 4 modifies certain definitions to exclude federal candidates. This is a little bit of an anachronism and preempted by federal law. States cannot set additional requirements on federal regulations beyond what federal law does. So that just removes what the executive director of the campaign finance board referred to as clearly unconstitutional language. Section 5, again, changes the definition of committee to refer specifically to only local candidates. Section 6 changes the definition of filing officer to recognize really how the process of questions, of how questions are placed on the ballot. Section 7 changes the definition of political purposes to specifically refer to actions relating to voting for or against a candidate. Section 8 amends reporting requirements to only apply to local candidates and clarifies those same reporting requirements. Section 9 clarifies what information is required to be reported. Sections 10 through 12 clarify penalties where they mostly apply to local candidates. Section 13 clarifies that contributions to these local committees also include contributions from other political committees and funds, as well as party units. Section 14 is actually, I think, kind of an important one, and it clarifies that any state officials, so legislators or constitutional officers who may be running for local office are still prohibited from accepting contributions from PACs and lobbyists during the legislative session. And then Section 15, is just the repealer. So that was sort of the walkthrough in broad strokes. I do have a testifier, but I'm certainly happy to go into more detail if folks are interested.
Sure. Why don't we take testimony first, and then we'll go to member questions. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
My name is Julie Green, and I live in Edina, Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Freiberg, and all the members of the Elections, Finance, and Policy Committee for letting me testify today. Local elections represent community voice in its truest form. I am a former Edina School Board member. I was elected to serve in 2019, and I just rolled off my four-year term. And I'm here today to support, to share my support for the House, this House Bill 3645. If passed, I believe it will bring accountability to the role political action committees are having in local elections across the state. As local elections across the state also continue to ramp up intensity and gain interest from groups outside their local jurisdiction, there is also an increase of PAC money contributing to these local campaigns, and this is either through individual candidates or standalone independent work. During my campaign in 2019, a PAC organization, Teachers and Parents for Edina, reported to have spent $3,440 during the election. For comparison, that was nearly 50% of what my entire budget was for my campaign. No PAC of this name is registered with the Campaign Finance Board. By law, if a PAC does receive more than $1,000 in donations, there are requirements. Tax ID number and registration is required. And I think it's also important to note that the donors that were listed for this PAC were also the same individual donors for one of my opponents. According to statute, this is a misdemeanor. But in our current system, this all went unchecked. It was disappointing and confusing to learn there was no oversight to hold a PAC accountable for the funding sources, spending, and reporting or lack thereof for local election engagement. This bill would change that. By putting a reporting structure in place with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board for PAC funds and their participation in local elections, this bill instills much needed transparency and oversight. This important step really holds PACs accountable and responsible. Our campaign laws need high standards for all those who participate in the election process in order to sustain election integrity at the local level. I believe this is what Minnesotans expect, and I encourage supporting this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the local school district last election, 6 of the 7 seats were open. And part of that was due to the pressures and comments, and it's higher profile than it used to be. And so there were members that decided that they're going to step out and not finish out their 4 years. And I think that local elections, I'd prefer to be local and not have that high pressure so you can go and serve. So I like the intent. I think maybe there are some things that could be improved on this before, and we'll get to talk to about it. But I hate the fact that whether you're in a small town or not, you're not immune to this kind of outside pressure from huge groups. So I hope we find something that makes it easier. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Davis.
Yeah, so you know, we all know Education Minnesota puts a lot into local races, thousands and thousands of dollars. Is this bill going to affect that at all?
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the question, Representative Davis. I guess, so what I would say is if this bill becomes law, Education Minnesota and any other organization of any kind that spends on any local races would need to register with the State Campaign Finance Board. I could not speak to how that might affect any decisions any of those organizations make with regards to what or how much or where they spend.
Representative Davis.
Okay, thank you. Also, is there anybody here today from Campaign Finance?
Yes. Yeah, I've seen the director is here.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I got a question.
Well, while he proceeds up there, proceed with your question.
I'm just wondering how much more work this is going to add to campaign finance board's workload already that, you know, they work hard for us. So
sure. Initial point, we do have there's a fiscal note showing a cost.
Thank you.
To the campaign finance board in your packet. So the bill is being laid over kind of for that reason. But welcome to the committee, Director Sigurdsson. Please identify yourself and respond to the question.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson, Executive Director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Representative, to your question, we believe that it'll add about 60 registrations per year. We found that there's about, in a 2-year cycle, roughly 200 local ballot questions every 2 years, and about 60 of those register, or I shouldn't say register, but file reports locally. So we assume that those are the committees that will now be registering and filing with the board.
Representative Davis.
So in your estimation, is that going to add a significant workload or not much or somewhere in the middle, Mr. Chair?
Director Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we believe the fiscal note provides that because of the size of our staff, it will have a significant impact, but rather than increasing the size of the staff, we would try to approach it through a one-time cost of having an online system for registration. Right now, it's a paper process where those have to be entered in manually, and then we try to support the new treasurer. Supporting the new treasurer is still going to be a task for staff and will be certainly a significant effort, but we believe by moving the entire registration and amendment process to an online application, that will benefit not only local committees who are in greater Minnesota, but it will also help all other committees and ease their registration as well.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Okay. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, in Section 8 of the bill, there's a $750 threshold. Is that taken, does that match up with other sections of law, or is there some reasoning behind that particular dollar amount?
Representative Coulter. I believe it does.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, I was reviewing the language, and I see, I mean, even just within that section, there are places where 750 is not underlined, so it's in current law. But that is my understanding, that it just aligns with current law in other places.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Coulter. I was just curious about that. It seems, you know, that in this day and age, $750 doesn't go very far. You can't get much if you're, at least when I'm buying stuff for my campaign, it doesn't go very far. And it's, if it's in other places in law, then it's probably an issue that should be addressed at another time. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional member questions? Okay. Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Coulter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for your time and indulgence. You know, I would just say in closing, I think these changes will better equip Minnesotans to know who is attempting to influence the elections that are closest physically and often emotionally to them. One of my favorite lines is that school board represents the intersection of the two things people care the most about, their kids and their money. And I agree in some sense. I think it is disappointing that this kind of outside spending has become so commonplace in local elections, that even when I ran for city council the first time in a large city like Bloomington, that was not really the case. But I think that perhaps is inevitable given the state of our politics. And I think what this bill does is acknowledge that reality and ensure greater transparency. So I think there will be opportunity to further examine the language moving forward, but thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. With that, the bill is laid over. Next bill is the bill that I am authoring, so I will hand over the gavel to Vice Chair Greenman. And if you could give us one moment, please. So I will move to lay over House File 3557.
Chair Freiberg moves to lay over House File 3557 for possible or for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. And I'd like to move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape I'd want. Basically, all this amendment does is remove the language related to replacing candidates. That language is still being worked out.
Great. Chair Freiberg moves to adopt the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Freiberg, to your bill.
Thank you. So this bill represents technical changes that strengthen existing statutes and small policy changes that continue the tradition of secure, accessible, and inclusive elections in Minnesota. These provisions include clarifying that the student voting list provided by a post-secondary institution can be used as proof of residence in conjunction with any form of ID currently permitted for Election Day registration. Additionally, the bill provides the option for an eligible voter to provide a physical description of where they maintain their residence if they live in an area that doesn't have 911 or street addresses. Providing a physical description of where a voter resides is currently permitted on the federal voter registration application, and this change makes this option clear on Minnesota's form. The bill also strengthens the language access provisions passed in 2023 that provide translated materials to voters on Election Day. Finally, the bill restores percentages based on recount thresholds. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Nicole Freeman from the Secretary of State's office to go into more detail.
Welcome, Ms. Ms. Freeman. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. I will briefly go through section by section, not exactly section by section, but to provide a little more clarity. As the chair mentioned, sections 1 and 2 clarify that the student voting list that institutions provide could be used as proof of residence, similar to any other proof of residence that is currently acceptable for Election Day registration, and allows them to use any other valid form of ID to register. Currently, the only form of ID that's accepted on the student voting list is student ID, and I think we had one election in 2023 of November 2023 running through that, and this is a recommendation coming from local election judges that it was a more confusing process for students, and then once we thought about it, decided to make that change. Sections 3, 4, and 30, as the chair also mentioned, allow a voter to provide a physical description of the location where they reside. This change would be made just on the paper voter registration form and would apply only if their residence lacks a traditional street address. This, again, is something that has come to us from the community, both people that live on Native Nation land as well as those that are unhoused will often put a P.O. box on their voter registration form, and that doesn't give us any information about where they actually reside. And by us, I mean county election administrators who are processing this. They need to be able to precinct the voter to make sure that they get the proper ballot for so they can vote on the people that are representing them. This would allow them to do that. Section 5 ensures clarity in the time frame when a local jurisdiction could pass a resolution related to how write-ins are to be counted for that jurisdiction's offices. In 2023, we allowed other local jurisdictions to pass different provisions related to write-ins and how those are counted, and this provides a timeline where they need to have that resolution passed by the time candidate filing starts. Sections 8 and 27 create the same standards for polling places if they're changed during any type of an election. In 2023, we inadvertently left off school district standalone polling places, and so this brings all of the potential types of election and potential polling places into the same configuration. Sections 9, 10, 11, and 12, those are the sections that make clarifications to the provisions passed in 2023 that expand language access at polling places on election day. Briefly, I'll run through them quickly. Because the data used to make the determinations of language accessed districts is updated annually in December, the Secretary of State's office proposes to make the determination just once a year by January 1st instead of 90 days ahead of each election, since the data is not changing throughout the year. Section 10 also includes a provision that came from our work to administer the section of law this year. We worked closely with a state demographer who recommended that we construct a confidence interval when assessing the margin of error and as we were determining which census tracts qualify as language minority districts. So that was a better way to use the data. Section 11 clarifies what language or languages need to be translated in the census tract. And then Section 12 provides a clear definition of what a sample ballot could be as it relates to translated ballot materials that will be available in polling places impacted by this section of law. Section 13 is a super technical correction that was missed in 2010. We no longer accept absentee ballots at the polling places, so we fixed that up. Section 14 clarifies polling place closing procedures on election night. 15 and 28 provide technical clarification that's needed as a result of changes made in 2023 to allow alternative ballot styles. Section 16 and 17 provide conforming technical changes to recount thresholds. In 2021, the standards were changed for the post-election review process, and these recount thresholds reference that statute. So what we did instead is remove the reference to post-election review standards and put in the previous percentage-based standards. So that's the more than two votes or 0.25 in order for a non-discretionary recount to be held. Section 18 is a conforming change to recount thresholds for ballot questions. Sections 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, and 29 include are sections that create a standard that notice must be given to the county auditor at least 84 days ahead of an election if a local jurisdiction for what they're going to have on their ballot or also if they're going to have a special election. Right now, there are certain elections that only 74 days notice is required, which creates differing timelines and causes delays in ballot production and printing. So this, the last sections of change are from our county election administrator's recommendation.
Thank you. Ms. Freeman, Chair Freiberg, do you have any other testifiers?
I don't, but you might want to ask.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify? Seeing none, and I caught Representative Bliss that you have your hand up. I think we're going to try to take the amendments first, and then I'll come to you. So I see Representative Torkelson. You have the A3. Do you want to move that amendment and describe it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move the A3 amendment. This kind of focuses on this language of people who don't have a normal physical address. And I guess I'd like, I think the intention of the amendment is to kind of narrow the field a little bit, make this, make it more accurate, even though it's not a regular 911 type address, but still a good description of Ms. Freeman described the need for proper precincting. I didn't know that was a verb or I don't know. Properly identifying the precinct in which the voter resides. And we believe that this language would help make that more clear. So I guess I would like to hear from the author and or Ms. Freeman as to how they think this language would impact the bill.
Chair Freiberg, what do you think about the amendment?
Thank you, Representative Torkelson, for offering it. I'm willing to work on this, but I'd recommend a no vote for now. I'm glad you're thinking about what details a county election administrator might need to put the voter in the proper precinct. This level of detail, I think, would be best in the directions part of the voter registration application. It might work pretty well in some areas, but there might be areas where it wouldn't. You know, I know the Secretary's office will work with local election administrators as they update the paper registration form to ensure usability for voters and clarity in what a voter will need to include should they provide a physical description of where they reside. I don't know if Nicole Freeman has additional comments on this too, but I...
Ms. Freeman?
Yeah, I think that just this level of detail of what might be required, I haven't ran this by county election administrators to see if there's any instances that this might leave out. And so I do think, though, that we would provide really clear directions on the back of the form where other directions exist to make sure that the necessary information is collected. And then also I know that our outreach team, also works with various communities and provides information, so can provide more extensive directions for those working in the communities that might be doing voter registration work too, to make sure that all those details do get on the form.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Freeman and Representative. I think about situations where streets are often the border of voting districts, and an intersection could describe as many as four, or be the intersection of as many as four different precincts. Yeah. So the effort here is to really make sure that this work is accurate. So I am trusting that the author of the bill is willing to consider this as a serious endeavor to do the best work we can. And as we move forward, I realize this is being held over. And I would hope that we can have some serious discussions about ways to improve this language. And I certainly appreciate the work of our county folks, and we want to understand how it affects their work. It's not an effort to make more work, unnecessary work for them, but it is an effort to make sure that our work is, that this provision handles this situation accurately.
One second. Representative Bliss, was your comment to the bill itself? Should I wait? Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the precision is sort of important. I've been around for a few redistricting after censuses. And I remember in committee of where there were examples of a line was drawn and the person's bedroom decided which precinct they were in. And that kind of you know, precision, I find in the current language isn't there. It's closer in the amendment language, but that's a concern that's been discussed, especially we've had where, you know, a house district was determined, you know, which bedroom you were, was it this bedroom or that bedroom you were sleeping in? So just a point when you're working on the language with the lead, work on that precision. Thank you.
Any further discussion to the amendment?
Madam Chair, at this point, I would like to withdraw the amendment. I would just as soon avoid no vote on what may be perfectly good language. And with the author's understanding or guarantee that we will work on this language between now and bill passage out of the committee, I will withdraw the amendment.
Very good. Representative Torkelson withdraws the A3 amendment. Turning to A4, that's also yours, Representative Torkelson. Do you want to move? And the A4 is also yours.
Oh, the A4.
Do you want to move and describe the amendment?
I do, Madam Chair, as soon as I get myself organized.
Take your time.
These 8 o'clock committees are a challenge sometimes.
For all of us.
Madam Chair, the A4 removes provisions related to location of residence on the registration form.
Chair Freiberg, how do you take the amendment?
This amendment kind of deletes the provisions that the previous amendment would have clarified a bit. So considering Representative Torkelson withdrew that one yes. And is now offering one that goes slightly further, I would recommend a no vote if we get to a vote.
Lead Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, sometimes the marble has to roll around a while before it falls in the proper hole. So I would like to withdraw the A4. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Torkelson. It got there, and we're all getting there this morning. Lead Torkelson withdraws the A4 amendment. And so that brings us to consideration of the bill. And I know that Representative Bliss has had his hand up for a while. So Representative Bliss, to your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't understand why we didn't take that amendment to delete the section. But I had a question for the Secretary of State's office. You mentioned that the Native Nations don't have physical addresses. Can you tell me which Native Nations don't have physical addresses?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bliss. We have had conversations. There are many that do, and there are many communities throughout the state that do include these types of addresses. And I know that counties have been working really hard, from a public safety perspective and emergency services perspective to get those addresses done. There's one location that I know for certain that I've had conversations with up in White Earth, where there are folks that live in places that don't have those types of addresses, and I will confirm what other places have been brought to our attention as well.
Representative Bliss, follow up.
And I guess, you know, this is just nitpicking a little bit, but that's something that the counties generally set up, and the nations have agreements with the counties. I know that Red Lake Nation is a closed reservation, and they had I personally helped implement the 911 addresses up there, mm-hmm. So I know they're completely mm-hmm. covered. Mm-hmm. And it just and I do represent the White Earth Nation too, so I'd be interested in knowing where that is.
Yeah.
So I can go talk to them and find out what's going on, because, you know, that's a public safety issue mm-hmm. that they don't have. And I remember there was a large pushback on the reservation when I was doing it. They didn't feel comfortable having the police know where they lived, but it was sold and properly so that we needed mm-hmm. that for the fire department to be able to get out there. So I just, in this day and age, as the saying goes, that we don't have physical addresses on all locations is interesting. And yeah, I guess I'll just save my powder for the ridiculousness of the whole provision for a later date. Thank you.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Freiberg. I guess my question is going towards, you know, this with being the elections chair and in the state of Minnesota, you know, really, I think all people, we want to make sure our elections are fair and honest. And could you please, you know, I'm really, really struggling with this, adding this language that we are now not requiring a specific address. How can you look the Minnesota public in the eye and say that this is fair, you know, that's it's going to enforce our elections and make them more secure?
Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Altendorf. Very easily, there are people who are unhoused who have as much of a right to vote as anybody. And, you know, it sounds like there's not a ton of tribal populations that live in homes without physical addresses or streets in the kind of, you know, conventional Western sense. So, you know, this is a this provision is consistent with requirements in federal law and the federal application. So I just see this as conforming to federal policy and ensuring that everybody has the right to vote regardless of their either living situation or address situation.
Representative Altendorf, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the Secretary of State's office, again, how can we verify, you know, addresses? How can we verify that these truly are voters in the precincts, in the districts that are voting, if there is no physical address? And as a state, should we not have some rules and guidelines so that we can look the Minnesota public in the eye and say our elections are fair and honest and we can verify all of these are legitimate voters?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Altendorf. What a county, it might help to describe sort of if a county election administrator received a federal voter registration application, which they come in regularly because I think when you do your change of address through USPS, you get this giant packet of things, and included in that is the federal voter registration application. So these do come into offices frequently. So if someone received that application today and someone, you know, indicated their physical location of their address as opposed to a street address, they would confirm that there is in fact it is in fact in an area that doesn't include a physical street address. So that would be the first thing. The bill does limit it to an area that doesn't have a traditional street address. So that would be the first, I think, check on things. And then additionally, they would, you know, then determine, you know, on the federal form, there's a map as well as some of the recommended items to include that were in Representative Torkelson's amendment. And so they would then look to those and pull up their precinct map and figure out where that person did live. So to Representative Bliss's point, you know, there is often at least knowledge that folks might live in a certain area when someone is registering. And I think that this is a piece of what we're hoping to do is provide an option for people to do this without physically coming to the office. Right now, if someone is unhoused, really the only way for them to be manually precincted is to come into the office to register to vote. This is a way that to try to allow the forms to come in other methods, similar to any other voter who might live at a typical 911 address.
Representative Altendorf, can I move on to Representative Quam?
Yep.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm a little bit surprised referencing change of address to the USPS because they don't deliver to a place that doesn't have an address. They don't deliver to a place that doesn't have, you know, a post office. You know, there's the mailbox.
Mm-hmm.
So there seems to be a little bit of ambiguity in that reference because they wouldn't have received that packet. So I think that your whole reference lacks accuracy. But to the author of the bill, why does it contain something that in the middle of the election cycle, after the poll books are generated, the certification of resident facilities?
Chair Freiberg, or maybe looking, do you want to, I see a puzzled look on their faces. Do you potentially have a site of where you're talking about in the bill?
It's where you've got the 20-day. There was ambiguity, and you tried to clear it up, that at least 20 days before the election, you would certify the residence list. So, like there are facilities where, people, retirement facilities, other facilities, where you'd have these lists. And it's good to clarify that it's got to be done, ahead. But 20 days before the election is after poll books are generated and in the middle of voting, because what we were allowed to vote for a month and a half. So I would think that would cause some issues. And if you're going to properly clarify, it probably should be before you generate the poll books, which definitely is before you actually have the early voting, because you have polling locations.
So thank you, Representative Quam. Ms. Freeman or Chair Freiberg, do you have are you clear about the question and have a response?
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair and Representative Quam. So the reference, are you in, so in our in the author's amendment and included changing the date to be no later than on line 4.11. And this is a residential housing list provided by a college or university. So this is a separate list that is not included in a roster and not included in or in a roster on election day or on an e-poll book. It's a separate list that is only used for a proof of residence. And so the reason to say that it needs to be provided no later than 20 days prior to each election, that was, again, feedback from our county election administrators in working with colleges and universities in their counties to get these lists, and that there's a time period where they need to receive the lists, their GIS folks help them precinct the lists, and then the counties distribute them to the municipalities so they can appear in the right polling locations. And so we wanted that list to come in no later than 20 days so that the counties have time to do that work to make sure that everything is ready for election day. The counties indicated to us that I think it's about 10 days after they start a semester that they're residential facility, both on campus, as well as their data for the rest of the student population that might live in the same city where their campus is located, that 10 days after school starts, their list is solid and doesn't really change. And so that time frame then gives them time to generate the list, get it to the county and the counties to do their work, so it's ready on election day.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Representative Quam, any follow-up, or does that answer your question?
No, because, again, this is in the middle of voting. If we're going to do some documentation for an election, do not do it in the middle of the voting period. I think that there is a sort of inherent violation in the principle of HAVA and the federal statutes. That whole thing was passed so that things were done before people started voting. That was the core intent. So I would hope that if we're doing something, we actually wouldn't have changes and lists and names injected halfway through the election. Because if the person comes in before that list shows up, there could be a little bit of confusion. And we already have, especially with first-time voters, accidentally going to the wrong polling location. So we want to have everything lined up before we actually start taking ballots. And so I would hope the author would look into a better way of clarifying this, because just in base principles, I find this falling short of where we should be at.
Thank you, Representative.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, or I mean, Madam Chair. The other part that I want the author to look at is HAVA required documentation. The state can do all these little things, but if we don't have the HAVA required documentation, you got to go to the SSA site. And Minnesota has a history of thousands and thousands and thousands of bad registrations on that site. And so when we sort of blur in the gray area, I don't want us to end up having more thousands and thousands of bad registrations in our system, because it just doesn't help with the voter confidence. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. And I have one more person on my list, and I'm going to turn it over to Representative Davis, but just notice, hopefully this can be our last question so we can move on to the next bill. Thank you, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might have a couple, but pretty short, or a few. Ms. Freeman, how many people does it take to vouch for someone to be able to register to vote in the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Freeman?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. It's one person who's currently registered in the same precinct.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Freedom. So one person can vouch for someone to get registered to vote. And how many people can that person vouch for? Madam Chair.
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do know that there is a, I don't know that number off the top of my head. I can look it up, but I don't know the number.
I believe it's eight, but if you could look it up. But I believe it's one person can vouch for eight.
That sounds right.
Okay. Let me look at our counsel, Matt Gearing.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's eight. Yes, correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gearing.
Representative Davis. So,
Ms. Freeman, so let's just use a scenario here. I hear you explaining, Chair Freiberg, the heart behind this. We want to be able to have homeless citizens vote in the election, correct?
Ms. Freeman, or Mr.
Sorry.
Chair Freiberg.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, so I can see clearly a scenario where you have a homeless person show up on election day to vote, get registered to vote. They've got one person vouching for them. How can we ensure that that person is a legal voter, an actual citizen of the United States of America? Because a lot of times they won't be carrying ID. They won't have mail. It's just one other person who could also not be a legal citizen vouching for them. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding that, and maybe you can explain that better. But to me, folks, this has fraud, the opportunity for fraud, written all over it.
Ms. Freiberg, and I think that there was a question about the vouching and how that works. And to to Representative Davis's question, or whoever wants to take it. Chair Freiberg.
Yeah, they still, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Davis. They still have to register. Falsifying information is a felony. Same goes for falsely vouching. Nicole Freeman might have some additional.
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you. And just to add that on Election Day, if someone does register to vote, they have to, and then wants to vouch for someone, they need to register using a proof of residence as well as a valid ID. And so if someone is going to register to vote and then intends to vouch for someone else, you can't register through a voucher and then vouch for someone else. So if someone was to come in, say someone moved into the precinct 25 days before the election, they would need to provide a proof of residence. In the case that we're talking about with a student list, that student list could be a proof of residence, and then they would need a valid form of ID. So that could be a military ID, a tribal ID, a passport, Minnesota driver's license or ID, some other form. And then they would be able to register. And so Minnesota state law doesn't allow someone who registers, and I can send the vouching statutes, but it doesn't allow someone who was vouched for to then vouch for other people on Election Day.
Representative Davis, any follow-up?
Yeah, so you're telling me they're not going to try this because they're afraid of getting a felony. And so my question would be, how many people are we charging with felonies when it comes to election fraud in Minnesota currently, on average?
Representative Freiberg or Chair Freiberg or Ms. Freeman, understanding that you're not in law enforcement and so may not have this statistic on your tongue, but
yeah,
Ms. Freeman or Chair Freiberg.
I don't think either of us has that number, but we can certainly try to track it down and get it to you, Representative Davis.
Representative Davis.
And I can tell you it's not very, thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. I can tell you it's not very many. It's not very many. In one of my own counties, I'll just bring up this scenario. In one of my own counties, I had a county attorney, Chair Freiberg, tell me when we were having this discussion, he had me look out the window down at the crosswalk. He said, Mr. Davis, when you came to the building today, did you use that crosswalk? I said, yes, I did. Yes, sir. He says, well, there's a lot of people who didn't use that crosswalk. And we were talking in terms of election fraud. What was he communicating to me? This county attorney was communicating to me, We don't take this seriously. This is a jaywalking violation. So I know for a fact election fraud is not being treated seriously in the state of Minnesota, and I don't think anybody is concerned about vouching for a homeless person to register to vote, whether they're going to get a felony or not. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Davis. And as a public defender, I will say jaywalking is not a felony, so treat it a little differently. Is a felony. Seeing no more, Representative Bonner, and just keeping it real quick because we have another bill to get to.
I will keep it quick, but I just wanted to suggest that, and I can't speak for the numbers, and perhaps Ms. Freeman knows them or can get them to us, but the number of folks who register on same day is a unique subset of folks. And of those, there is probably a percent of a percent who actually go through a vouching process, which would be what would apply in this particular situation. It might be helpful if you were able to get us that information, but I'm guessing that it's not real common. And in fact, as working as a former election judge, having someone actually vouch for someone in the precincts is extremely rare. It doesn't happen a great deal. I think in a large suburban city in which I was a judge for many, many years, if we had two or three in an entire day, that was a lot. So I just want to put that in perspective here before we go down some slippery slopes implying and impugning motives. Thank you.
Representative Freiberg, final comments?
This bill will continue the tradition of secure, accessible, and inclusive elections in Minnesota. Thank you for your consideration.
This bill is laid over. Handing the gavel back to you, Chair Freiberg.
Welcome to the committee, Chair Stevenson. I will move. The last bill on the agenda is House File 3625. I will move that House File 3625 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Would you like me to move the A1 amendment, Representative Stevenson?
Yes, please.
Okay, I will move the A1 amendment. Is this just to put the bill in the shape you'd like?
That's correct.
Okay. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill updates the deepfake statutory language that was adopted last year on a bipartisan basis. Last year, we were nation leaders in taking action to combat the threat of the influence of deepfakes in our elections. Since that legislation has passed, the need to be aggressive in combating deepfakes has been illustrated pretty dramatically in our presidential election, where deepfakes using what purported to be the voice of President Biden were used in the New Hampshire presidential primary process. Deepfakes are here, people are doing them, and we need to be very real about how we address them. So we did pass great deepfake legislation last year. This bill updates it just a little bit in a few ways. First of all, it adds forfeiture of nomination or office as a penalty for a candidate using a deepfake in violation of the statute we passed last year. It modifies the definition of deepfake to add content that has a fundamentally and materially different understanding of the substance or meaning of the content of the speech or conduct compared to the unaltered original version. It takes, after adoption of the amendment that was just adopted, the deepfake statute is only applicable 90 days before an election, general or primary. We add political party nominating convention, presidential primary, local primary, special elections to that list. And then we allow for injunctive relief, or just clarify the nature of the injunctive relief, injunctive or equitable relief. That's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. I have two testifiers on the bill. Secretary of State Steve Simon, if you could please come forward and identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify in favor of the bill. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I want to thank Representative Stevenson as well for his national leadership on this issue. He, and I'd say through him, the state of Minnesota, have drawn national attention to the issue of AI-driven disinformation in the election context. AI, which powers deepfakes, I would say is not in and of itself a threat to our elections or our democracy, but it is an emerging and powerful amplifier of existing threats such as disinformation. If AI-generated deepfakes are used to misdirect voters, the result could be disruption and disenfranchisement. In the hands of those who want to mislead, AI tools can represent a revolution in their ability to cause harm and corrode faith in our system. And let me just give you a couple examples. One a little bit old, one more new. The one that's a little bit old, not so old, but was a leaflet I remember seeing here at the legislature that was handed out in neighborhoods in Milwaukee on doors for the 2000 presidential election. And that leaflet, good old-fashioned Xerox leaflet, said something like this. It said, hey, voters, remember, next week there's a big election, presidential election. If your last name is A through L, you vote on Tuesday. If it's M through Z, you vote on Wednesday. That was 2000, just a quarter century or so ago, paper leaflet. Now imagine that same leaflet or the same content in the leaflet, the same attempt to misdirect voters on an election-related matter, in this case, election administration, the rules of the road. Now imagine instead of that quaint, old-fashioned leaflet, now it's a deep fake of the mayor of Milwaukee or a popular Milwaukee Bucks basketball player or a well-known faith leader. You get the idea. So it just amplifies the ability to get that message across, which is why the stakes are so high. The most recent example, I think, is the one that Representative Stevenson alluded to, which is the Joe Biden robocall. And I don't think we're done with that this year. We have not, to my knowledge, seen an example of that in Minnesota yet, and I hope it stays that way, but we can't just bank on that. So last year, with broad, I think, nearly unanimous support, you and the legislature passed the underlying bill that has really turned heads across the country. I can tell you that other secretaries of state, other states, red, blue, and otherwise, are very interested in the approach that Minnesota has taken. So while Congress has been debating sort of around the edges on disclaimer requirements, you in Minnesota sailed way past that debate and said, we're not going to do disclaimer requirements. We're going to enact a limited but controlled ban within 90 days of the election if there's no permission of the depicted person and if it's done with the intent to influence the outcome of an election. So this year, this bill, there's a chance to tweak and improve the law. I leave the particulars to you, but I support the direct action that this bill and the underlying law represent. I think, though, that laws like this, the underlying one, make me cautiously optimistic about AI and deepfakes. It's a problem, it's a challenge, but we've faced technological challenges before, as we all know. I mean, the arrival of computerization in the 80s was seen at the time as maybe a challenge. I wouldn't say so much a threat, but a challenge to election administration. Likewise, the arrival of the internet in the 90s, social media in the 2000s and 2010s. So each time we in Minnesota and nationally have adapted, and some of that adapting was done through legislation, but some of it was just human behavior. So I think we can do that again. I just want to point out very briefly that legislation alone is not enough, at least in my opinion, to meet the challenge. Election officials throughout the country are renewing the call to the public to really seek out and look at trusted sources of information to minimize the risk of deepfakes and other mis- or disinformation taking hold. That could mean our website, mnvotes.gov. If someone has a question about who's eligible and where to go and where the polling place is and what the hours are, our website's an example. Or if you don't want to go there, you can go to your county or your city. I just want to thank you for your time, your attention, and your bipartisan leadership, all of you, on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. The second testifier is Mary Hartnett. If you could please identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Mary Hartnett, Clean Elections, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Hartnett, Clean Elections, Minnesota. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I said, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm the Executive Director of Clean Elections Minnesota, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that educates and advocates for an inclusive and healthy democracy. Last fall, we hosted a forum on the threat of artificial intelligence and election interference with the Brookings Institution. This is an issue that is very important to us. Deepfake AI is turning the 2024 elections into an unprecedented test on how to police deceptive content that dupes voters. Last month's robocalls, as we mentioned, that with a simulated voice, encouraged voters not to participate in the New Hampshire primary. It's one example. Moreover, we believe that faith in elections is an essential democratic norm, and deepfake AI in elections can lead people to reject the very norms that we need for a functioning democracy. The World Economic Forum issued a report this year with the Zurich Insurance Group. They surveyed over 1,400 global risk experts, policymakers, and industry leaders about their biggest global concerns. AI-derived misinformation and disinformation and its implications for societal polarization ranked ahead of climate change, war, and economic instability in its top 10 risks over the next 2 years. There is no truth in advertising rule in political advertising. With paralysis in Congress, states like Minnesota are left to put up as many guardrails as we can to mitigate that threat. This bill, the provisions of this bill strengthen last year's deepfake bill, and Clean Elections Minnesota urges you to pass House File 3625. Thank you to Representative Stevenson for introducing the bill and to all of this committee for your bipartisan work and to your commitment for strengthening our democracy.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I have an A2 amendment. I believe that might be yours, Representative Torkelson. Would you like to offer it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment.
Okay, the A2 amendment has been offered. To your amendment, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment relates to the severity of the penalties that are being changed in this bill. I feel, you know, this is kind of new territory, deep fake work, as has been described by others. We're kind of ahead of the curve in many ways, and it's just had, the underlying bill has had bipartisan support, both here in committee and on the House floor. However, I would like to hear from the author his reasoning behind having such severe penalties in place for something that we're really at this point kind of exploring. It seems like we're going very far without a complete understanding of how deepfakes really might function in the real world. So I guess my question is to the author as to why he's gone this direction.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Appreciate the question. I think forfeiture is a significant consequence, but it's worth noting that the legislation that passed last year establishes that violations could be a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony, depending upon the exact nature of it. And those are, I would argue, very severe consequences. And a felony conviction might even be more severe than disqualification from office. I also would add that I think that while I support having the availability of forfeiture as a remedy, I think that most people would expect that most deepfakes won't be done by a candidate or candidate's committee, but by a PAC or an outside special interest group. In which case the forfeiture wouldn't come into play, because the forfeiture only occurs if it's the candidate's committee or that's done with the candidate's consent or knowledge. The candidate would have to be involved in the deepfake in order to trigger the forfeiture. So if a political party or some other entity runs a deepfake as an independent expenditure, right, without the candidate's knowledge, we're not talking about forfeiture in that instance. But it seems to me that if you have a candidate engaging in knowingly serious illegal behavior in order to win elected office that is of a degree so serious that 200 of 201 legislators last year voted to make it potentially a felony, that forfeiture of office is an appropriate remedy in that instance.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. So, as you know, I'm kind of a old guy and a Luddite, I don't profess to understand artificial intelligence very well, but it seems to me there is some potential that the artificial intelligence could be used to try and fake the indiscretion, right? That somehow we produce artificial intelligence that blames a candidate for using artificial intelligence. And you've got a two-step process here of trying to prove who did what, and taking people off the ballot is pretty severe.
Any comment, Representative Stevenson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, that would be concerning if somebody used a deepfake to try and prove that a candidate used a deepfake in an election. I would note that in order to violate the deepfake statute, you have to prove, and it's in this case, a criminal act, right? So you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the candidate knows or should have known that the deepfake, that they disseminated it. First of all, you'd have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they disseminated it, that you have to prove that they knew or should have known that it was a deepfake and that they did it with the intent to injure a candidate or influence an election. So that's a pretty high bar, and I think that if that has occurred with regard to a candidate, disqualification is appropriate.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you. Well, it's my feeling that the remedies you have in the original bill are adequate, and this is going a step too far at this point in time. It may be down the road as we venture on this path of trying to understand how deepfakes may or may not be affecting elections, that this may be necessary down the road. I just think it's, at this point, going a bit too far, and I would appreciate a green vote on the amendment.
Representative Quam, to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, what current offenses in the state of Minnesota disqualify a person from being elected or holding an office?
Representative Stevenson?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to phone a friend. I don't know if Mr. Gearing or someone from House Research can answer that question. I don't know the answer.
Yeah. Matt Gearing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, so if you look at Sections 1 and 2 of the bill, you see that there's existing law related to forfeiture of nomination or office, and that is in the Fair Campaign Practices Act. So it's the types of acts that relate to the conduct of campaign. So in that chapter are things like bribery, false statements, and other sort of similar types of acts that are fair campaign practices violations and then would trigger potentially these forfeiture provisions if the person is convicted of those.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. It would have been nice to have had that material or that list so we understand, similar justifications for this discipline. Now, to the author, a campaign committee. I know a lot of people that part of their campaign committee would be some teenagers that have skills in social media, internet, etc., because they grew up in it and it's natural. So a teenager involved in a campaign committee who's used to generating stuff decides to do a funny, quirky thing and it gets out and is classified as a deep fake because it's a sarcastic thing about the opponent. The candidate could very well not only not know, but not understand what that person did. And so I would think that there should be some clarifying along that area to preclude, because if we have non-clear parameters, a judge, jury, DA, etc., can go beyond what our intent is. Legislative intent doesn't mean a whole lot to the judge unless it's clearly stated, because we repeatedly have to go back and visit and clarify language because a certain judge totally went outside our legislative intent. I've worked with Representative Pinto on human trafficking for just such a case years ago because we thought it was clear and then it was interpreted differently. The penalty is severe enough to where I would hope we would be very clear or much more defined to prevent someone suffering because the teenage tech guy on your committee decided to do something funny. Because if you look on social media, there are a lot of little things that pop up there that seem to be normal, but in this instance have huge ramifications. So that's why I think we shouldn't go forward with this bill unless we've got the amendment on it, because I think the intent is understandable, but the execution in the current language doesn't quite meet the level that we need. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. You did tie it back to the amendment at the end there, so. Any response?
Mr. Chair, I think, Representative Crum, if you look at the language in the bill, your concern is directly addressed. There's no liability for a candidate if they don't know or aren't immediately involved. And so look at subdivision one of the language. There's two possibilities here. Either the candidate has to be directly found guilty or it was committed by another individual with the knowledge, consent of the candidate. So if the teenage tech guy does something without the knowledge of the candidate, there's no liability. So the guardrails you're looking for are in the bill explicitly. Furthermore, it all has to be predicated on a criminal conviction, and the underlying bill or the underlying statute that's already law requires as an intent of a criminal offense, so proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the candidate knew or should have known a specific intent. So I think that the concern you're raising is already addressed by existing law and the statutory language in the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair. We do have the ability to go a few minutes late, just so members are aware. I prefer not to go super late, so if members could keep their questions brief. And we are still on the amendment.
Right, right. The knowledge of, so if the line of questioning is so-and-so your tech person? Yes. Are you aware that they were doing your website and social media? Yes. Did they have authority? So I can see creative questioning and the right jury or judge deciding that they need to determine that he's responsible or that he should have known, and therefore they're going to go ahead and do it. I want to firmly prevent the severity, and I can see, because we've seen it on the federal side of where they just don't like the candidate, so it doesn't matter, and they just go ahead and do it. And they've fortunately had some of those overturned by higher courts, but in Minnesota, since this is specifically to Minnesota, I have concerns.
Thank you. Seeing no additional questions, we are on the, to your amendment, Representative Torkelson.
To the amendment, yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Stevenson, we have talked about this deepfake issue mostly as an issue of doing something that would diminish the candidate that you're opposing. What if I use deepfake to enhance my own candidacy? Could I be held responsible and potentially be convicted and removed from the ballot?
Representative Stevenson.
I think that if you used a deepfake that was designed to make you look better, that could potentially fall within the realm of what is defined as a deepfake. If you look at the definition, not even what we're adding in this bill, but the underlying language, says, believes the speech or conduct of an individual who did not, in fact, engage in such speech or conduct. So if I made a deepfake showing me rescuing a cat from a tree, right, when I didn't, in fact, rescue the cat from the tree to make myself look heroic, and then disseminated that within 90 days. No, but it says without the consent of the depicted individual. And so, since I am the depicted individual, unless you can say the cat didn't, so I think it would depend, is the answer, Representative Torkelson. The example I was going down, I was kind of tracking with you there, and I got thrown a loop by this consent element. I think it's conceivable that you could have a sort of pro-candidate deepfake that violates the statute. I do think that's possible. Like maybe if you fake the endorsement if I ran a deepfake ad claiming that you endorsed me in my reelection campaign without your consent, then perhaps that could fall within the realm of the deepfake statute, yes.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you. No one would believe that, but.
Aw.
But again, I'm just trying to back up my reasoning behind the not going so far with penalties here, because I think some of this is somewhat unexplored territory. And taking people off a ballot is weaponizing this in a way that I think is beyond what we really were thinking about last year when we voted for this. So I would resubmit my amendment and ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. The A1 amendment has been moved and a roll call has been requested. Are you ready on that? Okay. I'm sorry, this is the A2 amendment, the A2 Torkelson amendment. So the roll call has been requested. So the clerk will take the roll on the Torkelson amendment.
Chair Freiberg.
No.
Vice Chair Greenman.
No.
Minority Lead Torkelson.
Aye.
Representative Agbaje.
No.
Representative Altendorf.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Bliss.
Yes.
Representative Coulter.
No.
Representative Davis.
Yes.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Purcell.
No.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Vernig.
No.
There being 5 ayes and 8 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Any final questions about the bill? Hopefully not, because we're past time. Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Stevenson?
It's a good bill. Please vote yes.
Okay, thank you. With that, I renew the motion that House File 3625, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way.
Nice
step. Just so members are aware, we are not having a committee hearing next week because of precinct caucuses the night before. So it should be 2 weeks before we meet again. Any questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, we are adjourned.